and welcome to the Best Practice Network Apprenticeship Podcast, your space for real conversation that supports professionals working in early years, schools and apprenticeships. I'm your host, Emma Minchella, the Deputy Curriculum Manager for Apprenticeships here at Best Practice Network, and I'm joined by Programme Lead of the new EY Senior Leadership Programme, Tasha Singleton. We've got an exciting episode today, haven't we, Tasha?
Oh my goodness, I'm so excited. Today we are joined by Sean Douglas of Polka Dot Farm Nursery and also the Early Years Boardroom as well. And we are thrilled to have Sean here today sharing your wisdom, sharing your passion, sharing your enthusiasm for all things Early Years and actually leadership as well.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here, and I do hope that I'm able to share some little nuggets of wisdom.
I'm sure that you will be able to. But first, Sean, I would like for you to please give us your origin story, your backstory. I don't know whether that's superhero or supervillain or a mix of both.
Definitely a mix of both. I think there's probably a mix of both in all of us, right, Tasha? My story started, I was 21 when I fell pregnant with my daughter. I was in a career in the city prior to that, and I was just getting that underway. And whoops, Abby came along. And whilst I was really excited to go back after maternity leave, I suddenly realised that there were no good nurseries anywhere near where I was living at the time. And there was a huge gap in the market. So I decided that instead of going back, I was going to open my very first nursery. So at 23 years old, I found a piece of land on a school near where I lived. And I managed to set up a very small 30 place nursery, which was just going to be a lifestyle business for me, so I didn't have to go back to work. And within about 6 months, that idea had gone out the window. I realised there was a huge, huge gap in the market for excellent, well-led nurseries that were providing a real quality education and a nurturing environment for children. And I had the opportunity to expand. So that led me on a path of craziness for about the next 10 years, where I grew Dizzy Ducks from a single 30-place nursery to a huge chain that was spanning from East London through Essex into Suffolk. At the point of exit, we had nurseries out of school clubs, holiday clubs, breakfast clubs. We had nurseries as small as sort of 40 places, all the way up to our biggest, which was 177 places. There was about 150 staff, a head office, a training academy. So yeah, it was very small beginnings, but led to something quite remarkable, of which you played your part as well, Tasha, didn't you?
I did. I had the absolute extreme pleasure of working at Dizzy Ducks and just sort of just being swept up in your vision, Sean. It was amazing. Just the respect for staff and how that drove what you actually provided. And also that really exciting journey that we had when we swapped over, didn't we? We were doing curiosity approach and embedding curiosity approach into the setting as well. So it was absolutely brilliant. And I really enjoyed that. So do you feel that you learned any valuable lessons or takeaways from Dizzy Ducks? And you called it the point of exit. I know I can remember very clearly when the business was sold, and I think you were off to do other things. And then I remember just seeing somewhere going, oh, Sean's back in business. She's a nurse. Did you learn anything from what you did with Dizzy Ducks? And did it make it any easier, I suppose, when you then decided to open up Polka Dot Farm?
Yes, without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, I think it would be terrible leadership to say that that taught me nothing. I mean, the lessons there were just so abundant. When I exited in 2019, I had absolutely no idea that I would come back into the industry. I genuinely thought that was it for me. And I went off and did some other cool things, really enjoyed it. But an opportunity came up in 2022. And it was just such a good opportunity. I couldn't really pass it on to somebody else. Piece of land came up again in an area I know really, really well, very close to where I live. And it would kind of allowed us to put all of the good bits of every nursery that we'd ever had into one setting, and to call upon all those years of experience through both operations and strategically running a business and put them all together into Polka Dot Farm. So, I mean, yes, there are lessons across every single area of the business. I'm talking in operations, in recruitment, in, you know, the finance of the business, absolutely everything we did, we took from the lessons we'd learned through the nurseries that worked really, really well, the nurseries that maybe didn't work so well operationally. And I think the key thing for me was that, and you've already touched on it actually, is business is always about people. You know, we're talking childcare business, but I believe any business, if you can get the people bit right, then it makes everything else so much easier. So we've focused quite heavily on that at Polkadot Farm. And that goes from the apprentices from when they start being on that sort of journey of mentorship with other team members, right the way through to our strategic leads, our parents, you know, everybody being a stakeholder in the business. And we've done that through our social media channels to get everybody on board with what we're doing at Polkadot Farm, really understanding the culture and our values. So that was absolutely a takeaway from before. If you can get everybody understanding your vision, you're 90% of the way there.
Absolutely. I would highly encourage anybody who is listening today to don't pause the podcast. Wait till the podcast is finished. When it's finished, please go to social media and look up the Polkadot Farm. You will love. You will be just so enchanted by the way that you share your vision, the way that your staff are so open. They're clearly having fun every day.
Well, I think what it does, Tasha, is it showcases us. We call it warts and all. And you know, when we first started that, it was quite uncomfortable to be so raw on social media. But the idea that by being your authentic self, it pulls the right people close, and it also repels the wrong people. Mm. For example, we don't want people to apply for roles at Polkadot Farm if they don't want to be outside all day, or they don't want to spend time with the animals, or they don't believe in our vision. And there will be people out there that don't, and that's absolutely okay. But it just pulls the right people close. And that's the same for parents as well. You know, we're not the right setting for all parents. If parents are the sort of parents that they're worried about their children being outside, or they don't want them to get muddy, or, you know, go and feed chickens or whatever, we're absolutely not the right setting for them. And that's okay. And I think once we made peace with that and said, it's okay if some people don't like you, then it became a lot more easy. And by sharing what we believe in and our values and a little bit of silliness sometimes, it just absolutely pulls the right people close. And we also thought that, I don't know, sort of 2019, when I was exiting disease, it certainly felt like the industry was just a bit tired. We were all a little bit weary, and the fun, I felt, had gone out of early years. No one was on social media. Everyone was a little bit scared of that. And by coming in, I like to think that Polkadot Farm's gone, no, do you know what? Like, the industry's so fun. It's an amazing privilege to spend our time with these children. And we should be showcasing that, not be worried about legislation and health and safety and Ofsted and all the blah, blah, blahs, which of course we have to worry about, but not let it drag us down. Let's put the fun back in early years, which is exactly what it should be about. Sorry, I went a bit of a tangent.
Well, I love how you've kind of taken the boo of what they say is don't work with children and don't work with animals and gone, it's happening. I love that part of it. And I love your social media presence. It's so what I want to see. And if my children were younger and I lived in the area, it would certainly be something that I would be like, hello, registration form, please. Yeah, you've brought the combination of them both together beautifully.
And isn't that so true? I mean, I know we're going to go on and talk about what makes a successful business, but ultimately I've put into the farm what I would want for my own children. And, you know, I would want my children to be outside now. I think in a post-COVID world, we've all accepted that, you know, remember during COVID, we all were desperate to get on our daily walks. That's all we wanted to do, go and walk and walk and walk. And we realized that being inside four walls all day is just not the right place for us. So we've kind of had this shift. Whereas at, you know, Dizzy Ducks, Tasha, when we were working together, the idea about a good place for a nursery was by a train station on a commuter route so people could drop their children off and go to work. Now, where people have much more of this hybrid working, they don't mind traveling out to the farm, and they have this understanding that it's much better for their children. So, you know, that I think looking at it from a mum's perspective, or I'm going to be a grandma next year, or this year actually. So, you know, it just makes you see business the way that our customers are seeing it, is I think what I'm trying to get at.
You know what? Welcome to the Grandma Club. Have you seen last year? It is one of the most brilliant roles ever.
And I'm just sitting here looking at Sean's and thinking, what is her beauty regime? Well, that was not something I expected.
You didn't say that about me, but whatever. No. I'm joking. Sean, good, clean living. Absolutely. Lots of adventures, I think, as well.
Yeah.
So, Sean, the topic of our first sort of virtual classroom and the first thing that we are exploring in this senior leadership apprenticeship that we are doing is all about creating a strategic business proposal. And sometimes when early years leaders or early years folk, school leaders even, hear the term business proposal, it can be a little bit intimidating. It sounds very businessy. It sounds very corporate. How could you explain and maybe reassure our apprentices and our listeners who are, or anybody, I suppose, who is on this journey for the first time thinking about business proposal, what it means in simple terms?
Well, first of all, I'd say don't get freaked out by it because it's not as scary as maybe as it sounds. It is just a way of you showing that your business is sustainable. And by sustainable, I mean turning profit. Now, again, for years, profit was a real dirty word in early years. And if you were making a profit, you were like scum of the earth. And actually, you know, it should all be about the children and you should be reinvesting. But unless you make a profit, you can't reinvest. And you can't pay your team what they're worth and you can't buy new resources. So you have to show on your strategic business plan that your business is viable, sustainable, and that means profitable. So it really is as simple as what you are charging for your nursery, your childcare, whatever it might be, versus your costs. And at the end of that, having some sort of surplus. And it's looking in detail at how you are going to get to that point, because you're not going to open a nursery and be full instantly. So part of a strategic business plan for opening will be building that up. And if you're going to open a 50-case nursery and hope to be full after the first 18 months, in what sort of jumps are you going to build that? Is it going to be you're going to take three babies at a time so that you maintain your 1-to-3 ratio? Just see my point. Or are you going to try and fill preschool first? Or, you know, and also, are you going to be able to maintain that trajectory if you are loss making, which you probably will be in the early days? How are you going to sustain that? And once you've done those numbers and have it all strategic, it becomes less scary, because once you've written it down and you know those numbers, you can work with them. If you realize that on your plan, you are going to open with 15 children and you will be making a £3,000 loss a month for the first 6 months, you know that there's an £18,000 shortfall. You can go to the bank and work out a way of facilitating that. I think what people worry about is that they're not numbersy, they're childcare-y. And that's okay. But I would say then work with somebody that can help you do your business plan and do it in a way that you understand it. Numbers are only scary if you don't understand them. And I think if you are going to be in a leadership role, you need to make a real effort to understand those numbers. And then put some context around those numbers. So I'd always start with the numbers and then the strategy gets built around them. So, you know, if you've done your strategic business plan and you want to get to those 15 children in the first 6 months, well, how? So what's the marketing plan that goes alongside that? You can't just open your doors and just hope people are going to come along. It's not 1995. We're not putting adverts in the yellow pages anymore. You know, what is the plan, the social media plan, the community plan, the visibility in your local area? What is the plan that's going to get you to those numbers? And what are your benchmarks throughout that? So, you know, if you want 15 children within the first 3 months and we get to the end of 2 months and you're only at 5, you're probably not going to get there. So we need to be thinking about benchmarks. And there are people out there that will help you with this. If you aren't maybe focused on that so much. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. It does. And I think that's where it kind of differs in so many ways from the kind of more school strategic plans, because obviously looking at birth rates that are coming through, you know, we know that in early years, we're very lucky because we've got the funding that supports, and we've got so many parents that are going back to work that we do get the footfall. Obviously, when it's from that school perspective,
children have to attend school. It's a legal requirement. So they're able to kind of see the birth rates, the local area numbers feeding into them, which makes it easier. But you're absolutely right, Sian, when it comes to an early year setting, you've got to really look at what you're marketing. You're going to really look at what's actually around you and how you can get those children happily through the doors.
And what your market is as well, Emma, you know, if you are in an area where, you know, you might be in a super affluent area where parents don't necessarily have to, both men don't have to go back to work. So maybe you're looking at more of a preschool provision or a 9-to-3 provision, term time only. If you are in an area where lots of people commuting, then maybe you're looking at a 7-to-7 provision. And maybe if you are in an area of deprivation, you're just looking at sessional times with funded only. So you need to know your area. You need to know the demographic makeup of your area, and you need to know what other nurseries are doing. I would always do an analysis of what the other nurseries in the area are doing, what they're charging, what their session times are like. I would always phone round as part of my wider marketing plan and see if they've got spaces, you know, phoning up as a prospective parent. And if they've got spaces, that would be a real alarm bell for me. So yeah, there's lots of things that do go into the strategic plan. Sorry, once you've done the numbers, everything else funnels in. So then you'll have your operational plan, your marketing plan, and your financial plan that all sort of, you'll absolutely be able to funnel it all in together. Yeah.
Well, you've just mentioned that. What is the difference then, do you think, between a true strategic plan and an operational plan? I think that difference between operational thinking, making that shift to then strategic thinking.
So I would say the difference being the strategic is a lot more sort of helicopter view of the whole entire business. So our strategic plan at Polkadot, for example, is broken down into four key areas, the operations being one of them, the financial being another, the marketing side and recruitment, so team under one. And there's focus on all four of those areas, but it is an overview of the entire business, whereas an operational plan for me really is about how the business runs day in, day out. It's very much focused on childcare. It's very much focused on health and safety, legislative requirements. I can never say that word. and what we have to do. Everything else is more about where we want to get to for the business as a whole.
And you mentioned as well, too, you were talking about, you know, that market research and knowing your local area. I'm thinking about like almost like horizon scanning. How do you start to understand what those opportunities are for your setting, for your nursery, whether it's opening a setting or whether it's extending provision in an existing setting? How do you find those opportunities and maybe those funding streams or just understanding what your market research and what your data is telling you about what is need?
There's lots of different ways that on the council website, there will be your sufficiency data for that Emma's already touched on. There's also a section on there called Section 106 funding, which highlights where there are funding pots available for people to set up their own businesses, where it's been identified as areas of need in the local area. And the council are putting forward pots of money, or local developers are putting forward pots of money. So, for example, where people have, you know, where there's big like build areas, they're building like thousands of houses, there's the developers have to put money aside for community legacy stuff. And one of those being nursery provisions. So there might be 1,000 houses being built in a town and they'll have to put forward a pot of Section 106 funding, which is then put forward to for nursery provision. You can apply for that. So the developers don't do it themselves. You apply for it through the council and they will grant you money to build or put up some sort of provision in that area. So that's a great one to look at, that Section 106 funding. Otherwise, it would be just speaking to people in the local area. I mean, networking is just fantastic. Speaking to schools, asking them about their local provisions. I always look where the big chains are because they have millions of pounds to spend on demographic information. So if they've done it, then I would look and go, well, that's a really good area to be from a private provision perspective. If there's lots of of activity in the area with nurseries or preschools, I'd always look and see, well, that must be because there's a lot of need in the area. But just picking up the phone, I know we're also averse to just picking up the phone and speaking to people now. We're always sending emails or checking on websites. But actually, if you just pick up the phone and talk to people, people are so open with telling you stuff, or, you know, just phoning around and seeing what other local professions are doing. If they're full, then there's need in the area. I think just doing a little bit of market research can pay dividends.
So let's think about it, I suppose, as well, from somebody. I know that you've come in as director and as owner, and you're making a lot of those strategic decisions. But somebody who's in a position where you've got to upwardly influence or outwardly influence the people, you know, your board or your directors with your very brilliant idea for a business proposal, whether it's extending provision or improving quality provision or whatever it is, and you need to create a business proposal for them to get them to buy into your vision. You can't make them do it, of course, because, you know, they're the ones making the decisions. They hold the purse strings, if you will.
Yeah.
Do you have any advice for somebody who might be in that position?
Yeah, I guess so. I think that's a really, really interesting question. And actually one I'd not really considered it that way. I see what you mean. So somebody who's in a leadership role in a nursery, but in an employed position, trying to upwardly influence, I guess you need to know what the owners or stakeholders of that business, what their motives are. Why do they own the business? Are they doing it because they want to make a difference in children's lives? Is it maybe a small chain where profit is the key? Is it that they want expansion? Is it that they want an exit at some point? And once you understand what their reasons are, it'll be much, much easier for you to put together a strategic proposal for them. For example, if somebody is on an exit trajectory, maybe they are aging or looking to retire, whatever it might be, and you want to expand your baby room by another 15 children because you know you've got demand on your waiting list, maybe that's going to be a really tough call because you've got an owner who wants to sell out within the next few years. However, if you could put together a proposal that shows that by increasing by 15 babies, profitability will go up by X amount, and actually that will mean that it will cover the rise in national insurance for staff next year, plus it will increase their exit price valuation, whatever, that's great. So do you see what I mean? Like, or if it's about that their motives are actually providing a real excellent childcare and a need in an area where there is need, and you can prove that by increasing your numbers by 6 babies means that more families will be able to get back to work and access your provision, That's the strategy you'd go down there. But until you know what the person above you, essentially, what their motives are, it's going to be very, very difficult for you to put that forward. So I would say let's step that back a bit. That starts with communication. And if you've got effective communication with the nursery owner, director, whoever it might be, then you're going to start to understand what makes them tick a little bit more. I think that communication... I don't think it can be underplayed at all. I think if you're in a leadership role, you should be communicating with your director on a minimum of a weekly basis. Mm-hmm. And all the things I was talking about earlier about the strategic plan, you know, the finance, the marketing, the operations and the team elements, those four elements should be discussed at least once a week, whether that's a 15-minute call on a Monday morning and you quickly touch on those areas or whatever it might be. But you need to be having those conversations with them so you can make sure you're on the same page. And once those conversations start, you'll start to understand what it is that really motivates them, and then it will help you with your planning.
I suppose what we're talking about, the culture then, the culture of the business, really.
Yeah.
And what that means and how you can upwardly influence. So, and you've mentioned your staff as well and getting your staff to, how important then, I know you value your staff, and I know very firsthand how much you value your staff. What about staff buy-in then? How important is that to your vision and realize?
It's absolutely crucial. It's absolutely crucial. And if there is a disconnect between the director's goals and the staff motivation, it's never going to work. For example, if you see it a lot in nurseries that maybe are, I'm hesitating to say it, but like the Big Changs, for example, where there's huge financial motivations. It's all shareholders and pricing and all that sort of stuff. And there is a massive disconnect between that and the staff and managers who are there to do a really, really good job for the children and provide an excellent place for the children. So if there is that disconnect, there's going to be friction and trouble. Whereas if your team can totally buy into what it is you're doing or and understand it, then my goodness, it's just this really beautiful environment that everyone understands everyone's perspective. I'll give you an example of this. We had our managers meeting yesterday, our weekly senior leadership team meeting, and one of our runs wants to revamp part of their garden. But because of where we are on a farm, it will mean we need to do planning permission to put more garden space in. We'll have to rehome our chickens and we'll have to re-landscape the area. And I had to explain, actually, we can't do that right now because the cost of doing it will be about £25,000. And right now, where we're not sure what the funding rates are going to do, we can't commit that level of spending right now. But because I explained it, and I think the team understood that, it wasn't me saying no to it, it was me saying that the opportunity cost of doing something like that will mean that we can't then do what we want to do in our preschool room. So that they get it. It's not just somebody at the top going, we're not doing that, and you're not getting any explanation why. So I think going back to the communication, that's really, really essential. And getting the team to understand the why behind stuff that goes on is just, yeah, it would just destroy the culture for them just to not understand why we were making certain strategic decisions. I think that having the team hold me to account on some occasions is really good as well. And very often they will put forward ideas and I'll go, yeah, that's a way better idea than I had. Well, absolutely, go with your idea. But that comes over time. And it certainly comes from a place of respect and this excellent communication between us, I think.
I absolutely. And that trust, I suppose, that they have that trust in you, that, you know, that you can guide. But I don't know, maybe it sounds like a business proposal idea for your staff member who wants to convince you to extend your
time. Yeah, and we absolutely will do that because the case was so strong and she put it together as to why it would benefit the children and why it would be the right thing to do. And I was like, it will, just not right now.
This is
why you need to understand. But I think sometimes when that communication element's not there, those sorts of things become real friction points. Because they either don't get explained properly or they're not pitched properly.
I think as well, when you're thinking strategically, you can't just sweep those pitfalls. You can't sweep those barriers under the rug. You've got to acknowledge them. It's part of the business plan. How are you going to work around it? How are you going to make it work? Does it change the timeline? Is it a firm no? Is it a yes? But we need to figure out how we're going to manage those barriers. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it really does.
Okay. Any advice, I think, if you could give three pieces of advice to somebody in a position, like an early years position, who's writing their first business proposal, you kind of touched on a little bit, I think, but let's just bring it. What would you say? What advice would you
give? Three pieces of advice for someone writing their first business proposal. Okay, so keep it simple is number one. Keep it simple. Don't try and be something that you're not. If you are not a financial guru or someone that really understands like the nuts and bolts of how accounts work, don't try and be that person. Just do it from the heart and then everything else can be tweaked around it. So number one, keep it really, really simple. Number two, don't use ChatGPT. Everyone like totally AI crazy at the moment. And the problem is when people are using that sort of software to do this stuff, it's obvious. The banks know it. Stakeholders in maybe key positions know that that's what's happened. And I think it undermines the personal touch behind what should be in a strategic plan. And I guess, and that's absolutely to be avoided at all costs, I think. My third one, I think, would be go and get some help. one of my key lessons from my many years in leadership is that lesson that I don't have to be all things in my business. You can be really, really good at one thing and buy in help for other things. Now, for me, what I'm good at is the business side of things. So I would always get somebody from an operational perspective or an HR perspective or, you know, something like that to fill those gaps where I'm not so good. And if your role is that you are excellent operationally, and you could run a nursery with your eyes closed because you love working with kids and you know Ofsted inside out, you're not going to be great at maybe writing a business plan, but you can get someone to help you. You don't need to be fabulous. You do need to understand it and you need to put your heart and soul into it. But you can get somebody to tweak it for whoever is looking at it, be that the bank, a landlord, an investor, you know, somebody who's going to give you some money to get set up or your, you know, the people, your director or someone like that. You can get somebody to help you do that. There are absolutely loads of consultants out there that can do that. If it's that you want to set up your own business, the council have people that can help. So yeah, that would be my 3.1 point would be just get help. There's loads of people out there. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Or even if you are, you know, you're writing, I'm thinking of our apprentices on this program who are writing a business proposal and they're taking that to endpoint assessment. And there's a lot of stress around that, that there's still help available for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
They've got their mentors. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, wait. When you're in a leadership role, I think a mistake that people make is that they feel they have to be the best at absolutely everything. And whilst you have to have an overview of everything in a leadership role, one of those wonderful things is when you realize that actually, if you just surround yourself by people that are better than you, and your role becomes sort of delegating and managing the workload to people who are way better than you. An example of that is, you know, Dizzy Ducks, Tasha, you'll remember, I was very much at the center of everything that went on, but I had a marketing girl who was way better at marketing than me. I had an operational lead who was way better at Ofsted stuff than me. And
you still have her, don't you? Because she's your partner now.
Really. You know, there were people in key positions and I always recruited people who were way better at the role than me. And that just is such almost a release when you're a leader that you know that those people in key positions are really, really good and you can trust them. And then it becomes about managing and communicating with them. Not abdicating, I'm talking about delegating properly, and yeah, communicating your vision through them. So yeah, that can be transferred to this, and absolutely those people can get some help with their plans.
So it wasn't really, I hadn't thought about, you just led so organically into this discussion of what a leader, and we were having this discussion on one of my one of my classrooms yesterday, actually, about how a strong leader is confident enough in themselves to not be threatened by somebody else's knowledge. You know, are you a strong leader if you're so worried that somebody comes on who knows more than you do?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, all of the businesses that I work with, I can tell those businesses that are going to be super successful when I go and meet the team. And if the team are super highly qualified, really motivated, have the autonomy to be able to make decisions, but still under the guise of the owner or director's vision, I know that's going to be so successful. The businesses where they constantly have to ask for things, or is that okay? Can I do that? I'll just have to check with the manager. They're stifled by that director. I sort of hesitate to call them a leader because that's not leadership. That's management, micromanagement. And there's a huge difference between a leader and a manager. You know, a manager's just managing tasks that need to be done. A leader, I believe, kind of inspires people to incite change in a business and inspires people to bring forward their ideas and allows them the freedom to run with them and kind of celebrates when somebody has an idea that's not their idea and they run with it and it's called celebrate when that works. I mean, that's just fantastic when you can see that as a leader in a business, that somebody's really grown and has the confidence to run a project or something without your input. And again, people fall foul, I believe, of this, because they think, oh, right, I'm going to lead. I'm going to let everybody just do their own thing. But there's no cohesion there. So, you know, it always comes back to the culture and the values. And as a leader, if your role kind of just is all around your team and partners understanding what those values are that you hold dear, then, you know, it's just going to fly. It's going to be really beautiful.
Yeah, and I think good leaders aren't afraid of challenge, are they? You're not afraid to be challenged because you're secure enough in yourself. And thank you. I think you've just said that so beautifully. You've really summed up, I think, what this whole, the senior leadership apprenticeship is all about, really, you know, is that culture of team and what leadership really means. So I know you've launched, I've seen the early years boardroom. Do you want to just take a minute to tell us about that service?
Yeah, so the early years boardroom is it's a very, very small group of nursery owners, directors who are at very specific parts of their journey. So I run four different groups at four different levels, startup, level up, scale up and sell up. They're all pre-self-explanatory, but startup are the businesses in the very early stages of setting up a nursery or preschool that need help with those kind of key four areas that I've talked about. And we work through any challenges they might have, any issues on the end of the phone. We meet up once a month, get around a table, all of us at the same time, and just kind of brainstorm on that. The level up is people moving from maybe one to two settings. There are many, many unique challenges that come with moving from a sole site to two. And scale up would be anyone from sort of three sites upwards. Again, very unique challenges come when you start to put a head office team into a business. I've been through that and it was painful. I'll be very honest with you. It was painful going from sort of single site owner to two very, very quickly. And then many nurseries where you have to maybe think about your training. How do you embed that culture and ethos across multi-sites with lots of different managers who all require managing in very, very different ways? And then the last group is the sell-up group. So those people working towards an exit to help them get the best valuation for their business and move out of early years. So the whole cycle there, and it's fabulous. Everyone has very, very unique issues, and it's a very, very supportive, collaborative environment.
So where's the best place for people to maybe find you? If they want to know more about Polka Dot Farm, they want to know more about the early years boardroom,
Probably eyboardroom.co.uk would be a way to come through to me directly. I can always signpost you to wherever else you want to go. Polka Dot Farm is just polka.farm.co.uk, on socials at Polka Dot Farm. Socials are a pretty good way to start because you'll be able to see us and the craziness of the farm. And we are always welcoming people to the farm. So we often have these early years educator evenings at the farm where we talk about a specific topic. I think the last one we did was about outdoor learning, especially during winter. Because everyone says, surely you can't go out in all weather. I'm like, yes, we do. Yeah. So it was about how to make sure that the curriculum is accessible to all children throughout all sorts of weathers. And we do that throughout the year as well. So that would be a lovely way for people to come down and actually see the farm in action and take some stuff back to their setting. We love meeting other nurseries. We always learn as much from them as they can from us. So, yeah.
Excellent. So just one more question for you, Sean. Because you don't ever seem to just sit still. What's next for you? Do you have any plans, anything in the future? Or
if I told you, I'd have to kill you.
Yeah,
a few little plans, a few little different things. I mean, I've done so much in my career, early years and not early years. So there's a few things brewing. That's all I'm going to say right now. Sorry.
Watch this space, right? Watch this space. Yeah. Excellent. Oh, that's so exciting. Thank you so much. I can't thank you enough for joining us. I think your words of wisdom are going to really land, I think, with our senior leaders as they are, starting to make that move over from operational to strategic thinking. And I really appreciate that. Thank you.
My absolute pleasure.
Excellent.
So if you found today's discussion helpful, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, as your support helps more educators and apprentices discover our podcast. We'll be back soon with more conversations to support your journey. Until next time, take care.